Hey, welcome, welcome,
welcome,
welcome to the Marshaverse. This is a place in the rest of the universe where I come to make shit make sense.
From the entertainment capital of the world, Las Vegas, Nevada, it's midnight in the Marshaverse, starring Marsha Warfield and her two sons, Stephen Roberts and Skills Hudson, as the problem child.
Good morning. Welcome to Midnight in the Marshaverse. It's midnight o'clock. That's the witching hour between yesterday and tomorrow, which is right now. And it's also the Marshaverse. I'm Marsha. This is my verse. Anyway, welcome. We're going to have a wonderful show. I hope I get around to everything I have planned. I got a lot of things to talk about. Some of them I'll just be able to highlight, you know, and then I will later on supplement that and post that so you can get a broader picture of exactly what I'm talking about, or maybe a more in-depth picture. You don't want to, I'm going to give you the broad strokes. Marcia, wake up. But it's a lot of interesting stuff, and we're going to start from the position that, you know, we need to change things, but the first thing we need to change is our minds. So, like always, we're going to start things off with little refreshments. I am going to have my usual cannabis and cognac. My sons, who will come out later, will probably have an interesting array of refreshments. They're special, but they're mine. And so they might have, you know, bologna. That's okay. You have whatever you like. I am going to have some, I thought I was pulling out Courvoisier, but I ended up pulling out Hennessy. I had a little corner, you know, of Hennessy. This is the official cognac of Black people in America. And so here we go. I'm not going to have much because it's late. And it's not about, you know, getting blitzed and stupid. And sometimes I do, I forget what it, you know, the alcohol and the cognac and cannabis meets up with the dementia. I don't know where the hell I am. So we're going to keep it light. Oh, that's all. Tiny little bit. Not like your auntie who likes to, you know, come over and have a tumbler. You know, we don't let her come over too. Anyway. And we have some sparkling water back because you can't just drink straight alcohol. You have to have some water to keep things going, keep your wits about you. That's old folks giving you some game on how to stay aware. You know, don't mix your alcohol with sweet stuff and you'll be puking in the bathroom and people will take advantage of, you know, kind of thing. Get you some straight alcohol, whatever you like, and some water. Sip it. You'll make it through the night. This is a Yocan vape pen, and I have a heavy hitters cart in here. I don't know what strain, variety, it don't matter. We're going to do it. So here we go. Join me if you want. Just a little bit. And we're done. We're going to start things off. Now that we're a little toasty, with comediosophy. That's where one comedian's philosophy about stuff. And I wanted to talk about, I'm online a lot, and there seems to be this generational dispute all over where everything is boomers' fault, everything is Gen X's fault, everything is millennials. I don't know the difference. Y'all are y'all children to me because I'm a boomer. But it's like, it's almost like a campaign to keep you from enriching yourself with the tools that you need to survive by removing you from your personal griots. Griots. How do you pronounce that? Griot or griot? But it's your own personal oral history repository of people who have experience, who have affection for you, who will tell you the truth and tell you things that you don't have to accept, but can give you context about the things that you do have to accept and give you a more rounded and grounded way of looking at the world. So I encourage you to embrace the older people and not with so much animosity and skepticism, which I know is manufactured because we tend to rely on our elders. We tend to revere them when left to our own devices. And it's only when you put them up against the standards of the larger society, which does not, which is more about individualism and, you know, one man, one wife, one house, one this. Black people, it seems everywhere I've been or seen, are much more communal. We are much more, for lack of a better word, tribal, which is not a bad word. It's just not a capitalist word. But our family structures are extensive and expansive, and so we many of us are raised by our grandparents, our aunts and uncles, aunts and uncles, where I'm from, we don't have no aunts. But we're raised by our extended families. We have cousins and who we grow up with almost like siblings. And when we embrace that, then we get a much richer community. And we have a lot more community than we're giving credit for. You know, the mainstream paints a picture as they have since minstrelsy. They paint a picture that has nothing to do with reality, but people consume that. Minstrelsy is the oldest, it's the foundation of American show business. It's the oldest propaganda campaign against Black people on a grand scale. And it's evolved through minstrelsy, theater, radio, TV, cable, streaming. Those images still live in our collective consciousness. And so when we embrace our culture, our families, our history, our tradition, we have a much stronger base from which to face this world. And I also have not just this comediosophy of my philosophy that should embrace your elders, because I'm one, and the ones I know have so much to give you and want to. You know, there's a delight in having relationships with younger people from, you know, one generation down to their great grandbabies, if you can be fortunate enough to meet them. There's a real delight in that. And once you divorce yourself from the artificial standards that are presented through the media, entertainment and whatnot, and accept that and embrace that, you'll find a much richer way of looking at the world. But I am of the opinion that, and here we get into my sheology, it's the theology of the matriarchy of the Marshaverse. When we talk about religion, we it's always from a male perspective, which makes no sense. It just doesn't make sense. The universe is a womb. It's life. And there are many goddesses that we don't even know about. They don't tell us about them, but their traditions are old, and they have a reverence for a lot of people. And last week I mentioned Nana Baluku, but I mispronounced her name, and I apologize to her and everyone who worships her and knows her. But I do have some information about her that I'll include in the comments for you to check out. If my producers and editors are on their game, you're going to be seeing some links to videos that will explain who she was, who she is, and why it's worth knowing her, whether you accept that as your principle or your founding creation story for a larger belief system. And that is just good to be aware of her. And so I pulled up a video, a link to a blog from Mama Sunfire, who I follow on TikTok. And there'll be a link to her overview of Nukulu and a couple of others. And there, I'm going to be talking about some other TikTok creators and social media influencers who I think deserve to be mentioned and who I follow pretty religiously. Let me get myself together, and because I got a lot of thoughts going through my head. We are in a hell of a situation. They just passed a bill that is the beginning of the end of everybody's freedom for years and decades to come. It was inevitable. We saw it. We told you. We laid out all the things that could happen. And so it's no surprise that it is happening. The surprise is going to be on the people who believe, well, this is just, they didn't think about it, or this is just an accident if we just point out that, you know, this cuts out all of the social services and stuff. It takes a lot of money from poor people and stuff. Did you know that? You might want to change that. You have no idea. This is just the beginning. They are about to do all kind of crazy things that they told you they were going to do and that were inevitable. If we keep going with the patriarchal mindset where men fight men over decorum, over property, over control, over everything that determines our lives, you're going to end up with a bad situation because it's unbalanced, it's untenable. And I posted a video from a young man. Well, they're all young to me, but he was very, very macho, masculine, African, with the, you know, in his African garb, in his real masculine self. And he was saying how men today are sad, are crying, and they don't know how. They don't know how to express that or what to do with those emotions. We don't teach them. We don't allow them. Boys, don't cry. Run up against the wall. Don't cry. You don't be a man. And these are just totally unnatural expectations. When you have the balance of women who can nurture and put into not necessarily one man individually, but into the universe that it's okay, that these things that we're teaching are just wrong. It's just wrong to expect the things that we expect of men and women. It doesn't make any sense. And so you're going to end up with a lot of people who don't know what to do with their natural instincts compared to the systemic things that are being put upon them. They don't combine. They don't make sense. And so I put that video up and said, this is the kind of man, this is the kind of macho manliness that a matriarchy would produce. A man who was, like I said, strong, masculine, but able to speak about things that we don't consider manly, and able to embrace them and speak about love. In this society, it is more wrong to speak about love and caring and respect to each other. We don't accept it. We don't do it. We talk about what's wrong with everything. We talk about what all the problems are, but we never say, you know, if you think about it differently, you have so much power. You've accomplished so much. We have come so far, and we are right on the brink of success and devastation. The 92% of Black women who voted the way they voted, they want the success. They want the evolution, because we see what will happen if you continue to have these global pissing contests over stuff that's not yours, that belong to all of us, and that we all need and can use and contribute to and enjoy. And, you know, you can have your kumbaya, which ain't kumbaya. It never was kumbaya. Kumbaya, get me the fuck up out of here. It don't mean you my brother and I love you, even though you oppress me. That's some silly shit. But we have the capacity to make a world that's different, you know, that's better. And so one of the things I want to do, because I believe that this world needs to be mothered, and not just men, women need to be mothered. Our little girls need to be mothered. And to mother the world is not to necessarily scold and send people to their room and spank them and don't let them have dinner. It really means, you know, all of these people who don't know how to fight the demons that we're facing, who are tired and confused and upset. It means it's okay if you need a hug, you know. It's okay. It's okay. It doesn't make you weak. It keeps you from becoming the people who are trying to oppress you, which is what they want. They want you to be just as mad, just as greedy, just as, you know, combative as they are. But you can't. You can't think rationally that. And so as a Black woman coming up, who's always had to exist, not on the margins, but on a separate level, Black people have a culture, we have a history, we have everything that any other culture has, but it had to be built within a larger structure that meant to pretty much eliminate it. And so we've had to fight every step just to be human, just to be fucking human. And so a lot of women have contributed to this. I call it the sapphire spirit, because when the angry Black woman became the latest stereotype, she was popularized and mocked on Amos and Andy as Sapphire, the overbearing, ball-busting kingfish, but whatever, because I never watched the show. But I have seen clips of her, and I do understand that the Sapphire character is the ball-busting, angry Black woman. From the larger community's point of view, from our point of view, these are some badass women who have taken a stand when it could have fucking killed them. And so I want to highlight those women with that sapphire spirit who are not ashamed to be angry Black women. You're damn right I'm angry. There are things to be angry about. The hell are you going to tell me I'm not supposed to be angry? You're going to piss in my face, tell me it's raining, and that I should be happy about it? Fuck you. And it's really not anything that these women would even think about or debate. That's just natural. You know, and we never see her because we see her from the larger society's point of view. So we never see her, really. We see submissive, and sometimes they sassy, and sometimes they will speak up a little bit, but it's usually within a certain context. We don't see that Yassabos is what you heard because that's what you demanded for her to say. But they don't show how any Black person knows how a Black woman will say yes, a boss, which she means you are not my fucking boss. You have no right to expect that of me, but I have to do this because you have control over my life and my children. So yes, a boss. Is there anything else? We need to show that woman, and she has shown herself many ways. And this week, again, I'm gonna try to wrap this up and get into it. I want to talk about, because she was a show business legend, because she was the first that we know of to take a stand, make a difference, fight a whole system, and do it without showing her anger by presenting images that put the lie to everything that was being said about women like her. Her name is Ada. I don't know if it's Ada or Ida. Ada Overton Walker. And I have, I will link to videos and and articles about her bio. She was a fascinating woman. In minstrelsy, women were not allowed to perform for many years. And of course, Black people were not allowed to perform. They were white men in blackface and drag who created these negative stereotypes. And then when Black people could perform, it was in an awkward, untenable position. And I pulled some notes from my co-pilot about Ada Overton Walker. And it says, her life and career unfolded at the crossroads of artistry, resistance, and racial spectacle in turn of the century America. She wasn't just a performer. She was a cultural strategist navigating a deeply racist entertainment industry and subtly reshaping it from within. She went on to do plays. She did in Dahomey, Abyssinia, Bandana Land. And she was a leading lady, a choreographer, a costumer, a cultural architect, and she was the queen of the cakewalk. And if you're not familiar with with the cakewalk, this was a dance invented by enslaved people to mock the rigidity of white formal dance. And so they thought that was some funny shit. So they would get dressed up and they would high step, and whoever won would get a small baked good. They didn't have a lot to win. So they would have cakewalks. And then when the people who owned them saw that, they thought that was the funniest thing. And they didn't get that this was deliberate mockery because they didn't think that we had that much intelligence. So they just saw mockery by rote, and they began to demand these performances everywhere at their parties. And they would have elaborate cake and these cakewalks, which put the Black performers in minstrelsy in a delicate position all the way around. Everything they did had to be code switched. It had to be subtle digs that the white people wouldn't get. But every Black person would know these people were being mocked back. So it was mockery of people for being smarter than you thought. And so you make fun of them making fun of you. And that's been going on forever. This is the world Ada Overton Walker stepped into. And you've heard of Williams and Walker. Burt Williams and George Walker had a comedy. And when she met them and fell in love with George Walker, she became part of the troupe, Williams and Walker, and she was one. She was very popular. She was very good. She sometimes dressed in men's clothes and in her performances, and she sang, and she was just wonderful. And then her husband passed away, and she continued to work with Burt Williams and doing her husband's parts. She later on went on to do an interpretation of Salome, which is a very erotic character and has to be delicately handled. And that she became a sensation for the way she presented herself in all forms, whether it was an alluring sexual way. She was always a lady. And that was very important to her. She spoke of how, by simply presenting herself as a human, as a woman, she had the opportunity to advance the Negroes standing in the world. That how you show up made a difference, and it made a huge difference at that time. So I encourage you to know more about Ada Overton Walker. She was much more than the queen of the cakewalk. She was the first sapphire in show business, and I mean that. And I say that, I'm going to get to my guest, I got to get to it, but I say that because there's another YouTube creator. He's on YouTube. He's a Harvard professor. He's a linguist. He's a performer. He just does so much, and I follow him on on TikTok and Instagram. His name is Sun M Show. And he can break down complex premises and situations and make them very understandable. He's a wealth of information about Gullah Geechee culture, about the linguistics, about AAVE and how it is a real language and has a merit. And we need to embrace that because it's part of the culture that we have developed and thrived, you know, because as much as we have to deal with, when you look at it, not from the outside gaze, but from the inside gaze, y'all some bad motherfuckers. You just don't. If you could see you the way I see you, baby, you would do half of the things you worry about would just disappear. Because you have so much. You have accomplished so much. You have inherited so much that you don't see when you look in the mirror. You feel it. You know it's there, but you don't see it because nobody said, hey, baby, you know, and that's what old people do. They baby, you do you know how nice you look today? Do you know? And I saw you with your kids, and that you are doing a wonderful job. And they will tell you, we will tell you. We can't wait to tell you. I'm so proud of you. We can't wait. We will come to your graduation. We don't have to know you. We will come to your graduation and dance and clap because we are very proud of you. We are proud of each other. And we have to accept that it's okay to be proud of yourself because you've really, really come a long way. And so now I'm going to introduce my guest because he has made a career out of being that guy. That guy that, you know, his career, it don't take a back seat, but a big part of his whole career has been nurturing other people. I met him after I became aware of it. Here's the story. Okay. We were on the Tom Joyner morning. I've been to Tom Joyner Cruise, the Fantastic Voyage. And we're getting off the elevator, a bunch of people. I know Kim Whitley was there and Sylvia Traymore Morris, and then they were there, and everybody wants to take pictures. So we all get together to take the picture. I'm standing next to this man, and we take the picture. The next picture, he's not in it. They take a picture where everybody, the rest of us, are in it, but he's not in it. I didn't think anything about it because there were a lot of other people that I didn't know at that time. So when we posted them online, Wanda Sykes said to me, it went on the set of one of the shows where she said, oh, you know my mentor. You know my mentor. I said, who's your mentor? And she said, told me his name. And I'm like, I don't know him. Well, you took a picture with him. So I became aware that this guy that I took the picture with was Wanda Sykes' mentor. Come to find out later on, he's mentored a lot of people. He's going to tell you. Won't you please, and thank you for your patience, welcome my guest this evening, Andy Evans.
Hello, Marsha. How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I am doing well, and you know, it's good that you know my name because a lot of people don't. Every time I go somewhere, people say, you Mike Epps' father, huh? I've been told Mike Epps' father so much. When I go in restaurants, they let me eat free.
Okay.
So I don't say I am. They say, you Mike Epps' father? I go like this.
They don't even ask me. They just go, hands, mom.
But thank you. Thanks for having me on the show. And, you know, I by the way, you was talking about graduations. I come out of a big family. I got 9 brothers and 5 sisters.
Mm.
And my mother gave all of her...
Is a saint.
15. And my mother gave all of her 9 sons permission to cry because we had to take care of our sisters and everybody had open discussions. My mother and father was the kind of people that came out of the South. I came up in Alexandria, Virginia. So his father had 20 because they were farmers. So somebody got to gather the eggs and the chickens and the, So I came up in a big family. And, you know, I was talking about graduations. I told all my nephews and nieces, I said, when you graduate, I'm going to give you $100. Marsha, how many graduations do kids have nowadays? I've been to 9 graduations, and yeah, none of them passed the 5th grade. Head Start, preschool, farm school. I said, oh, my God. But that big family thing, your nephews and nieces, everybody's tied in. And, you know, it's funny. We was talking about the culture and comedy, how culture ties in. You know, the matriarch for comedy is Moms Mabley. Now, but let's dive a little deep into her. When she came to town, I used to catch her at the Howard Theater.
Okay.
Now, the Howard, the Apollo was built in 1935. The Howard Theater opened its doors in 1910. So when all the entertainers, Louis Armstrong, Count Basie, Billy Eckstein, when they came to D.C., they felt like they was home because they ain't had to come in the back. They ain't had to sleep in the cars. So home was them. But here's the amazing thing about what I remember about Moms. When Moms came to town, the word was, let's go to the Howard so Mom can tell us what's going on. And when she came out, she say, Mom's going to tell you the truth. Quit lying to those kids. So here's a woman who everybody went in there, and she was this grandmother that made you feel so good at the end that anything she said, look, she was invited to the White House by 2 presidents. The lady had an album when Nikita Khrushchev had rockets over there in Cuba. She do an album cover where she's got a shoe hitting Nikita Khrushchev. It's like, you don't lost your mind. See, that's that mother thing.
I saw they wanted some colored Astonets, and I wanted to know how come there wasn't no colored Astonets. So I went to the White House. I said, Linda, Linda, come here, boy. How come it ain't no colored Astonets in my home?
you know, it's funny. You was talking about Wanda. We're talking about females. When I was doing a comedy showcase in D.C., and it wasn't a lot of males in the show. So when I kind of came into the game, Keenan Ivory Wayans and those guys came in about the same time I came in. But when Wanda came around, I didn't have no females. So I put her in the showcase, and you know, it was hard for women to get any stage time. But I'm an old school comic. I always believe that you bring somebody along with you. So I said, well, look, I tell you what, meet me down at the comedy club where I host a spot, and I'll make sure you get on. And when I go on the road, I'm going to take you with me. So I took her everywhere, Philadelphia, North Carolina, any club, so she could get her feet wet. Now, here's the thing. I didn't make Wanda. What I saw was raw talent. Nobody make her, because comics have a, I noticed that what I liked about her, she wasn't doing the jokes the way the men did it. You know, like a man can see a woman walk by and we go, dang. A woman don't have to turn the head, can tell you what color socks, what color drawers. Okay. Whether or not he got a job. So Wanda had a style that wasn't typical of all the comics out of D.C.
Right.
And so I just thought that was interesting. So I used to tell her, do your stuff the way you see it, regardless of how other people see it. And so when she got on the road, Wanda found her voice. And once she found her voice, that little thing ain't slowed up since.
No, she hasn't.
No, and she,
let me ask, when did you get started? How did you get started doing?
So actually, I got to tell you, my first experience of seeing comedy was the Moms Mabley by going to the Howard. So I didn't think
what you said. She said, I'm gonna tell you the truth, but mom's was a living lie.
See, well, you know what? I think if you saw her in person, she talked about a life for real, for real. It just wasn't no social media. Moms didn't hide nothing, but when she came out and they created this image of her liking young boys, that was a comedy bit that she would do. You know, there ain't nothing the old man can do for me but bring a message from a young man. It got her laughs. But I don't think she knew that. Look, moms are doing blackface. And she said, I ain't gonna wear blackface no more because I got in this business to be known. And anybody gonna know who I am if I got on blackface? So I think my just was fascinated how you knew mom's real life because in D.C., she lived in D.C. So mom's dressed like a guy.
Yeah.
Just like she just.
I got eight of old Walker over here.
Yes.
And then
yes.
Mom's over there in a suit.
Listen, when she came, she hung out on U Street, which was Black Broadway. So if you're doing those days, you know, stars didn't have bodyguards and all these people. You knew that was mom sitting over in the corner. So okay. it was a place right next to Howard called Cecilia's. And if you knew somebody, I used to sneak in. So, you know, like the Temptations being there or early years. So moms would be over there sitting in the corner. So she always said, hi, sweetie. And you always felt like everybody felt like she was their grandma. She made you feel that way. So I think for me, I didn't think about stand up, but what did get me stand up going, I was in Vietnam in 1966. And I didn't plan on going. I had a car. I was living in Alexandria. I was hanging out with the brothers, 19, and I got a letter said, greetings. I thought a sister invited me to a party. Come to find out, I was drafted.
Right.
So when I was in Vietnam, up in Pleiku, up in the highlands, Bob Hope bought a whole caravan full of entertainers. And I mean, I was in an area called Dragon Mountain where there were 20,000 guys. And he didn't do the show in a safe zone. He flew in on helicopters. And he bought Miss Universe, which was a lady from India, and she was chocolate. He bought Anne Margaret. He bought Nancy Sinatra. He bought Scoy Mitchell. And so what got me was, Bob walked out on the stage with a golf club and he would say jokes about the army and the guys. And he was just so naturally funny that everybody forgot that a war was going on. They could have bombed us, but we were right there with him. And for them, the time he was there and he bringing out all the acts, that kind of got me interested. So long story short, I started doing stand-up, got to the point I was headlining improv and clubs. But when I went to New York, I couldn't get in because every time I went to New York, I knew all the guys, but I couldn't get on till 1 o'clock. Come to find out, you know, Bill Maher, Jerry Seinfeld, all of them was coming to a club called Garvin's, including Eddie Murphy. Mm-hmm. So I realized other guys had agents. So if you didn't have an agent, you wouldn't get on till about 1 o'clock. And everybody was trying to get on Johnny Carson and all the late night shows. So I never got on. So when I went back, I went up to Howard University and I wrote a show called The Soul of Comedy. And I put a young Martin Lawrence, a young Tommy Davidson, a young Chris Thomas, Tony Woods. I just got all the black comics and said, well, we're going to create our own stage. And the show was really successful, but they didn't know what they had until Martin broke out, and all of a sudden his show became a hit, and Tommy went out there with In Living Colors, and all of a sudden it became the biggest fundraiser. So after that little experience, I thought we was gonna go syndication because Howard's radio station had gone syndication. It was only black college in the country that was in a number 10, a top 10 market in radio. But they decided to keep it as a classroom for the television station. So I flipped over and opened up a club with a partner of mine named Greg Poole, another funny comic out of DC, and I opened up the Solar Comedy Club. And I was still, we was right to jump out right before Def Jam and before Comic View, we was rolling right in DC. But that was good. I was so proud of what they did with Def Jam because they gave the inner city comics a chance to showcase. And it was funny as hell. So I said, we're going to break necks. So next thing I know, Marsha, the hotel went bankrupt and they wouldn't let us back in the hotel. I said, I got a spot in there. They said, you can't come in. This place is taken over by the feds. So, you know, I kind of went from there and I was always thinking that if we can create some shows here in DC, look, I'm a back up and say one thing. I wrote the book Revolutionary Improv. And I say in the book that DC is the mecca for stand-up comics. Now, I say that to say, not that DC got the best comics, but if you are a good comedian, you want to play in DC. And I got that from Berry Gordy, who got the Lifetime Achievement Award when they reopened the Howard. And he said the first place he sent all his acts was to DC because DC had the most sophisticated audiences and they seen the best since the turn of the century. So if you was real and if you had a real act, you wouldn't steal in somebody's, they could tell a fake. So I always say that comics all wanted to come to perform in DC because we got politicians, a bunch of crooks sitting up on the hill. We got Chocolate City, the most chocolate city at the time, all combined in there together. And then you got the all the revolutionary brothers, the Hanafi Muslim, the Black Muslim, everybody's in that little crab. I think what I tried to do with the book was to write some of the history because what they've been doing with this DEI is just purging the books. And look, Toni Morrison said it's our job to write our history. It's our job to do just what you're doing. She said, this is the time to stand. This is the time when artists need to be out there doing just what you're doing, Morrison. That's what Toni Morrison said. And I thought, okay, let me just write as much of the history that I could research. So I started off with some of the DC comics, but I went into Moms and Dick Gregory and all of these comics. It's a group called Butter Beans and Susie. You ever heard of them? Maya Angelou was coming through DC and I saw her and I said, Miss Angelou, do you want to come to my club? I'll give you a front. She said, I love comedy, but I'm only in town for half a day. She said, but you ever heard of Butter Beans and Susie? And I said, I kind of, she said, they were so funny. And then she said, that was the act that Mom was the opening act for Butter Beans and Susie. I was like, get out of here. I didn't know that, but that she took Moms on the road. Because Moms was born in Brevard, North Carolina, left when she was 15 because she had a grandmother who was 108 and one was 110. See, if you talk about the matriarchs and families, I had aunts who was funny as all get up. So when you went to the family union with my family, your uncles may crack the joke, but as soon as my aunt had a little drink and she put that cup up.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Don't listen to him.
Oh. She was coming out.
Let me ask you, and you can tell me no if you want to. I'm 71, and you, when you talk about revolution and all that, that puts me in a time frame. So what years are you talking about?
So I went back with the book. I went back to as early as the 40s. Now, in terms of, I talked about comics of the turn of the century, but what reason why I started at the 40s, on the back of my book, I got a picture of me and Dick Gregory. So I hung around Dick for about 2 years, just picking his brain about, he told me when he saw Mom, she was a dancer singer with pretty legs. He said, she wasn't doing stand-up. He said, the guy that owned the Apollo told her to get out in front of the stage, while they set up for, say, Count Basie or Duke Ellington, because when those bands came, they had their own separate. You didn't play on that instrument. They had the initials on the front. Right. So moms took a little grandma hat and would walk out in front of the cage with the curtain behind her, not open, and she would do comedy until they got set up. That's what Dick told me. He said, so she would be a dancer, singer, and then she always was funny, but they, when they saw that she was so funny, he gave her that space. And as she kept on talking about her grandmother, she grew into that act.
Okay.
So I was trying to stay in a reasonable, but I went far back as vaudeville. I went back to the early years. Look, Marsha, you know it had to be back during slavery. You know when Master left, the brothers put together those cotton bags and made a stage and did jokes on the man.
Okay.
Because we always had comedy.
And all kind of stuff and made jokes. Banjos, they took gourds and put strings on them. And you know they also made a few corn cob pipes and put that skunk in there and you know, had a little something going on.
Yes, and they did. Yes, they did.
A culture and a vibrant community that again, we only know through somebody else's eyes who doesn't want you to see this as worthwhile.
Yeah.
But we have to be protectors of it. And we could talk about this until times get better, but we'll be here until 2047 if we keep on going. I have to bring out my sons, and they're sitting there, they're chomping at the bit. And I want you to meet them. We're going to start with Stephen this week. We started with Skills last week. We're going to start with them. And they have this thing. They make their videos that let us know who they are. So, Stephen, let's see what you have to say this week.
Hi, I'm Stephen Roberts, and this is my 2-minute rant. If you're going to be a Klans person, at least put your hoods away, hide them before you leave your car. I mean, come on, this is ridiculous. What kind of Klans person does this big mistake? Now we all know who they are. I mean, my God, the nerve of some people.
So, Stephen, he always get those license plate things, seeing people's. Anyway, he's got some wonderful stories, and he is my my oldest son, and he looks just like me. He looks a little like his dad. Anyway, say hello to Stephen Roberts.
Hello, hi. Stephen Roberts.
Hi, Andy.
Yeah, back there, I was just talking with Steve, and Steve was breaking up some brownies. He was weighing those brownies out.
Did you make them?
Hey.
Stephen, did you make brownies?
No, those were bought for me by my husband from the store, and they were really good.
Well, Stephen does bake and cook.
I do. I make some really good brownies.
Anyway, we'll get into that.
Did you believe that video? That video is crazy. You're right. I look at people's cars, and I looked inside a car this time.
Okay. But hold your horses. We're going to bring out your brother. And,
okay.
This is my baby son. He's such a ladies' man. He's one of these men I always admire because they're not scared of women. Women love that about them. So he's going to tell us about his life in the streets with his video, and then we'll bring him out. And Skills, where are you this time?
Morning, famo. Skills from the streets here. Well, the alley right now. But is it Monday? Yeah, it's Monday, about 9 a.m. here in Vegas. And the noise you hear is my laundry. Yeah, Skills be everywhere, baby. Headed up here because the public limo stop is a shortcut through this alleyway right here. Alleyway. because I'm going that way. But headed up there, about to go wash these clothes, run some errands. Errands be run. Tonight I'll be over there at Jimmy Kimmel's opening for Lunel. And Marshaverse, I'll see you this Friday. How we do it? Midnight in the Martian.
Skills in the alley. Okay. This but playing Lil Richard. Say hello to my problem child, my baby boy.
What up, Andy?
What's up, Skills? I see you, my brother. How you be?
Man, I'm good, brother. I'm good, man.
You ever been to Chocolate City?
Yes, man. Yes. And before I even got into stand-up, I was attracted to, you know, DC comedy comics, even though I didn't know. I just, you know, they were from DC. I was just, you know what I'm saying, was enjoying them from Def Jam, you know what I'm saying, from Dominique to Red Grant. You know, Tommy Davidson, you know, all the ones you were and other ones you were naming. And so when I got into comedy and I started in LA and I was getting an opportunity to meet these guys, and you know what I'm saying? And then when I first time I did DC Improv.
Ah, okay. Okay.
Yes. And you know, and just like what you were saying, just you know, I remember an audience member coming up to me right after the show. Well, you tell that truth, don't you? Yeah.
You know, DC Comics, I think they, a lot of the guys like Tom, early on, all the comics was just like jazz performers. Everybody hung together, right? And everybody had their own style. Even when David came around, I used to take him on the road because he was 16. And he called me one of his mentors. But the reason why he called me that is because when he came in, I just said to him, all of us, all the comics were 20 and up, right? Dave, about 16. So I said, look, he said, well, any advice? I just said, well, look, do the things that your generation talk about, how they feel about stuff. Don't go in there talking about, yeah, man, I got this bitch. And because you look like a little skinny 16-year-old. You ain't got no woman. You just learn how to figure out. So Dave, he said, okay. So when he went up, he started doing jokes about he got in a fight and this guy hit him, and he starts seeing the same things that Batman saw. Sock, pow, click. And he always thanked me for that. But I think I was always a guy that, you know, Marshall, in my book, I got you in my book. You know that, don't you?
Oh, really?
You're on page 179. I did a thing about national acts. And what I said was, I didn't want to talk about who was the funniest. I wanted to talk about what was unique about individual comics that drew their audience in. No valuation on any of us funny, because I was talking about you, about your having this ability to have timing that you have in your jokes and the pauses. You allow your audience to really get into the joke. And, you know, when you did that joke about you didn't know how they saw you, and you said that joke about, well, I got on a bra, and but the timing, and then when you did the thing about the black is a new orange, a lot of comics want to get to the punchline so fast that they have to learn about saying something and watching a comic take that joke and let people think about it, and then bam, and that's how you hit them. Marshall comes right back with that energy. And I think a lot of comics sometime are hide behind that joke, so they want the punchline.
Yeah.
But just to come out from behind that mic stand and be raw, that takes a lot of courage. And a lot of people get out of comedy too because they did some jokes at home. But when you sitting there and you got to do 5 minutes is one thing, but all of a sudden you in the audience in the improv and they don't seem the best, you naked. And if you ain't willing to be vulnerable, then you ain't going to work too well in stand-up.
My advice to young comics is always be yourself, because you cannot fail at being yourself. That's the only thing you can't fail at. So set that as your goal, to be
as much you as you can, and you will always succeed.
Well, you know, Marsha, you know, you got a style where you don't have to say nothing. I fell in love with Marsha, Steve. I'm going to tell y'all. She did a bit, and I told her, because she didn't say nothing, but it was the funniest. When her and Richard Pryor did the dinner thing, it was no words, but you knew exactly what was going on. Right up to the moment they dived off the damn table into each other, it was just like, damn!
That's its own story, honey. That has its own story I've told too many times. But I appreciate the compliment. Y'all sometimes take the show when I'm trying to, tell everybody how wonderful everybody else is. Then they want to turn it on me and tell me stuff. Whatever. This ain't what it's about. I'm all about y'all. And having said that, I know my sons have questions. Who wants to take the first one?
I'll take it.
Okay.
So, Andy, when you go to different clubs, you see that audiences have their own character, if you will, in different cities. So there's a particular kind of audience in Denver. There's a particular kind of audience in New York. There's a particular... What kind of audience, or let me ask it a different way, what do DC audiences expect? What are they used to, and what do they expect when they go to the club?
Well, DC audiences have, like I said, seen the best of the best. So you really have to have your set together. You see a comic, he knows how to stack his jokes up and build them up to the crescendo versus one joke here, one joke there, ha, ha, ha. It don't work too well in DC. But here's what I find for me. If you bring me to a town and I'm down in Winchester, Virginia, I buy the local newspaper and I'm going to read that paper and find out what's the most everybody in that town is tied into. And I find out that they got a high school, got a great football team. So I walk out on the stage and they looking at me and I'd say hello to the crowd. And I may say, let's hear it for the Red Roosters. Well, the Red Roosters is the mascot for, Now I got them, they okay with me. So I try to suck up to the audience. I suck up to them fast to let them know it's okay. We're going to have a good time. Sit back and relax and just go for it. And I think once they see the comfort zone, you can say anything if you do it, if it's not being mean for no reason. You can get into a lot. But I think smart comics know people pay to see you. Ain't nothing worse for a comic to say, well, I'm going to get paid anyway. I don't know if you can get away with that. And then you get mad and, and I've seen guys stop a show and say, I want this guy put out right away. By the time they get the guy, put him out, the crowd now is shrinking. Now they don't know if you're going to get mad. No, ain't nothing worse than a pissed off comic.
Attacking them. As far as they know, they see you attacking an audience member, well, they identify with them or her. So why are you attacking? You have to wait until they get tired.
Yes.
Once they get tired of them, you can say your mama sucks donkeys. Don't matter. They will cheer. They will stand up and they will start to put that person out. But you can't attack them, the heckler, because most what people call hecklers are not hecklers. They're helpers. They just want to be part of the show.
Yeah, so exactly.
Out. And so I got a joke or a ha ha ha. And actually, it's their show. They make it in. So it goes how they want. Y'all want to be the audience? Y'all want to be funny? I'm going to stop you from being funny. It's about us having a good time. It's only when they get mean or they get over the top. And once they get over the top, like I said, you can say somebody needs to beat you with a hammer.
Yeah.
And the audience will. But I'm going to ask Skills. What he's got to say.
Okay. Well, basically, I don't really have a question this week because the interview was so informative. The only question I do have is the about the book again. I want the name of the book again.
It's called Revolutionary Improv.
Revolutionary.
And there's a history of stand-up comedy, DC being the mecca. So it's up there on Amazon, but I'm going to run around the country. I want to open up a discussion about naming some of the comics that perhaps we all forgotten. You know, there's a guy named Clay Tyson. Marsha, did you know Clay Tyson?
No.
He was one of them comics that was right around the time of Moms, but he didn't get the same attention, but these guys came and bumpity. But what these guys did have was road warriors. They just went from club to club, and they were so sophisticated that when they walked up in the spot, it was a guy named Wild Man Steve. You remember Wild Man Steve?
I do know. I have heard of Wild Man.
He could just get out on the stage. Is another comic named George. He used to come out on the stage and say, "Look at everybody." Have a cigarette in his hand and say, "Everybody relax, have a drink. I am." And put his hand behind his coat, and he had a cup dispenser. Marsha, he would pull out the drink from behind his suit jacket. The crowd would go bananas because he was so cool the way he started his act. And Marsha, let me ask you a question, Marsha. Don't you think them first 5 minutes is really important when you're a comedian in terms of setting a tone for where you're going with your set? I mean, if you just come out and say, tell a joke, then you may get a ha, ha, ha. But that 5 minutes in which you come out and they just want to look at you. You know, sometimes comics don't allow people to look at them. Marsha did a thing where she said, "I got on fedora hat." She described what she was. So now the crowd's got to look at her. And then she sneak a punchline in and throw a joke. Well, some comics ain't comfortable to me with the way they look. If you're a fat comic, then I mean, a lot of comics made a fortune off of being a fat comedian and doing jokes. We had a guy named Fat Doctor. You know, Fat Doctor come out for Thanksgiving talking about some, "Yeah, all of y'all, how do y'all do for Thanksgiving?" And everybody say, "You have turkey?" And they go, "Yeah." And you go, "Yeah, well, I had turkey and I stuffed it with a ham."
Yeah.
Oh, my God. You know, the crowd go crazy, you know. But I think the style, just like when I was, it's a certain, when you see, say, Marsha, your good friend George, George Wallace. George act like he just had a party from the time he walks out. He just, you know, you just in it. Eh? He ain't going to let you sit back.
Right.
And then he can go anywhere he wants. He may sit on a stool. He may get up. He may bring you. He start doing mama jokes because he feels. And Steve, it goes back to what you said about what town you're in or where you're playing. If you're really good at what you do, you ain't got to change your act for your audience. The audience come to be entertained by you. And that's why I say the really good ones. Marsha, I got to tell you one thing was so funny. I don't know if you saw it. Richard Pryor was on Johnny Carson's show, and he had came out with the album Bicentennial Nigga.
Yeah.
And so Johnny Carson introduced him. He says, "Ladies and gentlemen, I got the great Richard Pryor, and he got a new album out called Bicentennial. I don't say that word, so I won't say it." Then he brings him out, and then they talk for a few minutes. And then, you know, Richard being funny, then he bring out the next guest. Richard moves further down. And as he's talking to his next guest, Richard kind of leans over and says something like a little joke. And Johnny Carson says, "Shut up, nigga." here's a mind-blowing thing. You can pull it up and see it. Richard went from a smile to a real, what did you say?
Say what?
What'd you say, bro? And Johnny Carson, you could see the fear, because Richard Pryor looked like he was getting up out of the chair to get dead in Johnny's ass. And Johnny didn't know if Richard was going to come up and pop him. And then Richard laughed just to bring it back. But it was such a give and take, because Johnny thought he got Richard, And Richard turned that joke right back on his ass.
That's the Saturday Night Live bit. Hunky, nigga, dead hunky. That's that bit. And it just, it brings up what I was talking about, Son M. Show. He was talking about how in Goodfellas, he said, oh, I'm funny to you. And he explained how that can be interpreted so many different ways, and then ties it all into code switching. And it's a very interesting thing. And it's interesting you brought that up. But like I said, we've been here, we're way over time. And we'd love having you here before we're going to say formal goodbye. But, and hopefully skills will come back. But while we wait, Stephen.
That's a really good look, don't you think, for skills? That's a reason.
It depends on what you consider a good look. I mean, that could be a lot of things. And we, you know, you're welcome to come back anytime. We've had a ball.
Anytime you want me, my dear, I'm honored to be on your show.
And your book, we want to be able to show pictures and let people know where to get it.
Okay.
Get a copy.
And I'm looking forward to, hey, there goes skills back.
All right. And what were you about to do?
No, I was saying I'm looking forward to, I'm going to be out there, hopefully get out there in August sometime out in Vegas, you know, love to come through your spot. I ain't did too much work out in Vegas, but I'm looking forward to come out there and seeing what's out there. Maybe catch some work.
You know, it's the same old grind like it is anyway. And Andy, when we talk again, we can talk about Irwin C. Watson. What's his name? There's so many. Timmy Rogers. There's a whole story about Timmy Rogers.
Wow.
And his contributions. So, anyway. Thank you so much for being here. Did you know Ronaldo Ray?
Yes, I know Ronaldo. Yeah, I did my club. I booked him in there. He was so funny. There's a lot of weeds out here.
Well, he has a documentary coming out that I saw the part of the preview last week, and it's all about his life, his contributions. He wrote Superman Lover. Did you know that? All the shows he's been on, and he's another name, another undersung.
I would love to people to throw out names and bring out comics that they heard or they remember, because we need to bring rise some of these names back up so people can even go look up, you know, the Godfrey Cambridges and, you know, even Flip Wilson. People forget how he was one of the funny
stories about him. And, you know, at African American History Museum, before this administration decided to gut it.
Right.
The seventh floor that shows how the explosion of culture in the 70s, 80s, 90s, they had a lot of comedians. They had Butterbeans.
Yes.
They had all those comedians from minstrelsy on. They put everybody in there. They tell me I'm in there somewhere. I don't know. But still, there's a lot of information that we need to acknowledge and preserve.
And preserve.
Like you, helps us in that way and gives our young people.
That's the beauty of it.
To learn.
I'm one of those folks that thinks that these are kind of shows that gives people a chance to sit back, relax, and it's not anybody dogging anybody. I'm not knocking those shows, but a little too edgy. I think sometimes people forget. People come to comedy because they want to find something to get off the chest and enjoy. They don't need to feel bad.
All the time. Don't nobody come to a comedy show to be mad. I hope he pissed me off. You know, they give you grace. They give you 2-3 minutes, total grace. You could scratch your butt for 2-3 minutes. They do not come to hate you. You bring that attitude. We got lots of lessons we can give. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Anytime you need me, Marsha, I'm glad to be out. Showcase anytime. Appreciate you. Okay, thanks. Thanks a lot, Steve Roberts. Good to meet you, my brother. Also, Skills Hudson. Hey, looking right, forward when I come out on the West Coast, maybe we catch up. And if you come to D.C., holla. Okay?
Yeah.
I'll look you up and see, can we get some work out there?
Revolutionary Improv.
Hey, that's the spot. That's the spot.
All right. That's a promise. Thank you again. And you have a good evening.
Take care. Appreciate it. Y'all take care out on the West Coast. All right.
That was lovely, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah,
he's great.
We got carried away. There was so much more stuff. We got half a show to do.
That I love when somebody is on the show that y'all have known each other for years and y'all just get to talking and we enjoying that, but we learning also, and my nipples get hard.
Well, thank you so much for the visual. We really, that does it for this week. I think we got to all of the things we wanted to talk about. The Jim Crow Museum is in their middle of their expansion, and they have a traveling show called Overcoming Hateful Things, where it's their exhibits going to different museums. I think right now it's going to Tennessee. You could check their website and just Google it. It'll come right up. I did. Then it's going to, there's a schedule that lets you know where else they're going to be. And the Ada Overton Walker video that I linked to was made by a school and museum. The school that video came from is the Lyle Station School and African American History Museum. I didn't get a chance to get real deep into it, but it seems to have a history in that region of preserving the history of Black Americans in that part of the country. I think it's in Indiana. So I'm going to link to that because we believe in preserving the culture. And I didn't get to the question I wanted to ask you guys, because I think when we talk about the sadness of men today, a lot of it has to do with we no longer know how to communicate between men and women now that women have become more comfortable in their sapphire and men are not used to the equality that's being exhibited. And I think I can help the younger people if they could just, especially younger men, if they could just ask a lesbian. So I encourage you to ask me any question, because who would know better how to bridge the gap between men and women than a, left of femme lesbian who has an understanding. So if you have a question, ask me, send it in. You guys, I have a question for you, but we're going to save it for I'm going to ask you now. I'm going to ask you, I think most women want to know, what does it mean when you don't take off your socks during busy time? What are you telling that woman?
Well, what do you keep yours on for, bro sis?
Well, you go first on this one. How about that? You're the expert on making love to women. Oh, okay. So you go first.
Okay. Well, I would keep my socks on because you know what I'm saying? With raw feet, you gonna slide. And then if the moment y'all enjoying, she gonna get upset because you slipping and you might slip a little bit too far and don't have enough instrument to keep going. But if you got socks keep you planted. So you ain't going nowhere, and I ain't going nowhere. I'm right here for the mission.
And on that note, we're going to say goodnight and encourage you, if you have a question that you've always wanted to ask a lesbian, or if you have a relationship question that no one else has been able to answer, then give us a comment, and do the like, share, subscribe thing. Please, we do this for ourselves, basically, but we'd like to know that you enjoy it too. So if you have questions, comments, whatever, let us know. We'll be back next week. In fact, I'm going to keep on talking until it is next week. Show is so damn long. Anyway, thank you. And Andy, love you. And we love you all. Y'all have a good evening. Bye-bye.
Got a way, no one can do it like that. Her own style, no one can wear that hat. Hey, don't you know that the